The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. First of all, we'd like to thank N+1 and Blue Stoop for co-sponsoring tonight's event. Thank you all very much. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm a producer and editor here in the Free Library's Author Events Office, and I'm pleased to be here to introduce tonight's guest, Elias Rodriguez. Elias Rodriguez currently teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, and in the fall of 2021 will start as an assistant professor of African American literature at Sarah Lawrence College, focusing on African American literature, Black Marxist writing, Black feminism, and critical prison studies. His work has been published in The Guardian, The Nation, Book Forum, and N+1, where he is also an assistant editor. Elias joins us tonight with his debut novel, All the Water I've Seen Is Running. It's the story of a mixed-race son of Jamaican immigrants who is called back to his Palm Coast, Floridian hometown to investigate the death of his first love while simultaneously pondering the mysteries of his own family history and identity. A review in the New York Times says that the author infuses both the malaise and socio-political concerns of his generation into a novel built on other noir staples and praises it for prose as measured as it is nuanced. One note on tonight's interviewer. Tonight's author was supposed to be in conversation with author and state senator Nikhil Saval, but unfortunately he was called away last minute for a budget session meeting. Such are the demands of government. Instead, we have the great pleasure of Rachel Ossip as our interlocutor. Rachel Ossip is a designer, writer, and editor based in Brooklyn, New York. She serves as the managing editor of N+1 magazine and the designer for N+1 books and manages the contemporary art imprint Paper Monument. She also teaches at the Rhode Island School of Design. Elias, Rachel, thank you so much both for being here and take it away.
Thank you so much for having us. I'm not Nikhil. I'm sorry to everyone who's expecting Nikhil. It will always be my great displeasure to not be Nikhil, but it is my great pleasure to be here with Elias and get to talk to him in Nikhil's stead. It's such a pleasure and an exciting debut from Elias. And I had the great, honor of getting to read and work on a little bit of the novel a long time ago when we excerpted it at N+1. And it's just been so exciting to see, the full thing and get to read through it. And yeah, I can't wait to talk about it more. Elias and I talked a little bit earlier and we thought that maybe we'd kick off tonight just by having him read a little bit of the beginning of the book to give everyone here a sense of what's going on. And then we'll jump into conversation. As was said, we'll spend the last quarter of tonight doing a Q&A. So, think about that, put questions into the Q&A at any point, and we'll get to those toward the end. So yeah, Elias, congratulations and take it away.
Thanks, Rachel. Thank you, Jason, also. And thanks to the Free Library for hosting us. And of course, N+1 and Blue Soup for hosting. And thank you to all of you for being here. I'm really grateful for it, even if I can't physically see you. I'm going to read from the first 5 minutes of the novel. And this is, well, I guess I don't need to give you any preface because this is the first page. Back then, we body surfed until salt water rushed into our sinuses and pushed liquid mucus out our noses. When we tired of trying to catch the tide, we waded out, stopping to dive under incoming waves. Above us, the rushing water sounded like wind heard from within a plane landing. We surfaced and continued out to where we could not touch. We treaded and bobbed in the tide and congregated on sandbars. When that exhausted us, we swam back to shore and baked in the sun until the day turned to a haze of half sleep. We lived for water, salt, fresh, and brackish. We waited out school days for the weekends and school years for the summers to return to it. We stood on our river's mud shores and cast lines, hoping to catch something big, only ever reeling in catfish. We wriggled our hands into their mouths, unhooked their slimy insides, and tossed them back into our brackish river. After sweat and spray coated our faces, we kicked off our flip-flops and swam in murky waters. When the sun stole our shade, we moved on to the next shore or pier or dock or dinghy. We were all waiting for life after high school, after our no-name town in North Florida, so we figured we'd wait by the water. On the best nights, we saw the glint of moonlight rippling on a current. I spent many evenings with the girl I loved in high school, Aubrey, trying to touch the moon's reflection, our hands plunging through cold waters as if digging in the sky. I liked to stand in the glow and pretend we were characters in some fantasy book carrying out a ritual, my hair standing on end as the magic took hold. But I think it was just the feel of Aubrey's eyes on me, a black boy on the wrong side of skinny, who never thought anyone would want him, least of all her. The longest night we spent on the biggest river that runs through Palm Coast, the Intracoastal, was when I was 17 and Aubrey was 18. We made plans at lunch. She was waiting at our table and I hoped to rush through the free lunch line at school, but it was longer than normal. The growing number of middle-class kids in line, all of whose parents worked in real estate or landscaping, suggested something was changing, but I wouldn't learn what until the 2008 housing crash gave my county the highest unemployment rate in the state that had the highest in the nation. By the time I retrieved my lukewarm burger and French fries and joined Aubrey, a dark-haired girl standing to about 5'6", lunch was almost over. After we shot the breeze, I asked what her weekend plans were. She said she didn't have any. I said we didn't have a track meet tomorrow, Saturday. She said we were going fishing that evening. Lost in daydreams about the night to come during my classes and at practice, the day passed by in a blur. On the school bus home, Des asked if I wanted to kick it. I said I was hanging with Aubrey. He extended his hand, dapped me up, didn't say anything else. When I got home, I told Mom I was spending the night at my friend Twig's house. An hour later, she dropped me off, and after she left, I drove Twig's car to Aubrey's house. In her neighborhood, every street name started with a B: Bird of Paradise Drive, Buffalo Bill Place, Brushwood Lane, so everyone called it the B section. The houses there were bigger and the lawns better kept than in my part of town, but Aubrey's driveway seemed poorly paved for the neighborhood. I knocked on the window and she came out. Her hair was up in a ponytail and her teal Abercrombie shirt was just short enough that it exposed the sea bass tattoo on her waist. I tried not to stare, but I kept glancing at the curve her hip bone drew. "You could have rang," she said. "It's late," I said. "My folks don't care," she said. She opened the garage. We hooked the dinghy up to a red truck as I tried to avoid looking at the Confederate flag bumper sticker that I assumed was her sister's. Then we got in the car and drove to Bing's Landing. As we pulled in, shadowy Spanish moss swayed from the branches overhead. We passed the one-room barbecue joint and the small grass square that made up the park. At the river's edge, silhouettes swung, and I heard a hook splash into the Intracoastal. I was trying to distinguish the line from the night when Aubrey reversed the truck down the ramp and the dinghy into the water. We got out, detached the boat, and held it still. "Get in," Aubrey said, barely more visible than the shadow people in the distance. "Where are you going?" I asked. "To park. Can't bring the truck with us." "What if I float away?" "Hold on to the dock," she said. Then as she walked away, she muttered, "All them book smarts, not a lick of common sense." I got in and grabbed its rough wood beams, which felt like they might splinter into my hand. The water bobbed beneath and I worried I would fall. Moments later, a gray-blue hue to her skin, Aubrey returned with the spear, the bucket, and the lamps. "Can we turn the lights on?" I asked. "Gotta wait till they're in the water," she said. "I can't see anything." "Are you afraid of the dark?" "Thank you."
Thank you, Elias. If it wasn't Zoom, I'm sure there'd be uproarious applause right now. It's the prose is just like so sharp, and it's such an atmospheric book overall, and we're going to definitely get into a lot of that in a second. But I wanted to start with kind of the most generic question, which is if everyone was paying attention to your bio, you know, you work, you're an academic, you write a lot of nonfiction, you know, if it's essays or criticisms or research work or reviews. So I'm curious about, you know, why a novel and why now, and what were you hoping to find by working in fiction?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I am just not good with quiet time. You know, maybe I just need a lot of jobs. But more accurately and specifically, you know, this book came out of a pretty tough time for me. You know, it started around the time that a good friend of mine from high school passed away. And I was dumbstruck and I was sad and I didn't like doing anything anymore. I didn't like watching TV. I found that boring. I didn't want to do my work. I found that boring. Even my friends, I think talking to them got hard. So I was grieving, you know, in short. And unfortunately, over the next several years, I went, you know, I either went to or was invited to several funerals of many peers and some elder people. And so I was sort of always being confronted with what it means to grieve, what it means to grieve someone who has gone young. And unfortunately, I was not mature enough to write about this directly. You know, after basically everyone around me was like, you have to go to a therapist, you're losing weight, you're like quiet, you're, you know, you're sad. I went to a therapist and the therapist was like, why don't you try writing about this person, what happened? And, you know, I sat down and I had this like blank page in front of me and it was too intimidating. You know, it was too much. I couldn't actually talk about it directly. I wasn't mature enough at the time. But instead I started writing in fiction about someone who is grieving. And I did this kind of at a slant, you know, I mean, I wanted to write about someone who was doing things really different from me, partially because I couldn't deal with, you know, the present. I couldn't deal with what I was dealing with. And I also wanted to do it because I didn't know what my obligations were to this person, to my people, to the community, you know, who knew her and were friends with her. To write about this person in nonfiction, I didn't know how I could do that responsibly. So I had to write about it at a slant. This is kind of to say that, you know, and this is kind of tautological, but I wrote fiction in a way because I couldn't write nonfiction. You know, I couldn't actually do it. On the flip side, I think, you know, my favorite novels write fiction for a reason. You know, they take advantage of the fact that fiction is a very particular technology. Now, of course, the difficult thing about this is that as you continue to write fiction, you know, you meet certain characters. And in my case, it was Daniel's good friend, Desmond, who would not shut up. He had so much to say. He took up so much space on the page. And I was like, what's going on? I thought I had control. And now I've lost control. And this character's talking so much. And, you know, in a way, eventually fiction acted on me, you know, and I just sort of decided to lose the reins and try and just transcribe what I was hearing in my mind. And that, I think, is more or less how I came to the book and why I wanted to write a novel. I wanted to write a novel because a novel afforded me things that nonfiction couldn't. And I think that that's, in my mind, what a novel should do.
Yeah. We've talked a little bit at other points about, you know, like the autobiographical rhymes in the novel. You know, you grew up in Florida in a similar area, and there's some other things that have these autobiographical details that some people could read and start to try and interpret. But it's, you know, it so clearly had this other function for you. And yeah, I just, you had told me some funny things about friends of yours reading the book. And if you would maybe talk a little bit more about that as well, that'd be great.
Yeah, it's funny. I am a good friend of mine, you know, listen to the book on Audible. So also if you're an audiobook person, it's on Audible. Listen to the book on Audible on a long drive, like the day it came out. And then he was texting me and asking me, you know, if X, Y, or Z happened. And I was like, you were there in the version of this in my life. You know, this didn't happen, you know? And
yeah.
It's funny, you know, I mean, fiction does have this kind of like disappearing act where it makes you wonder if something is real, even when you have all the information and you know that it is not real, you know? And that's really special in a way, you know, that fiction can kind of disrupt what reality is, you know? I mean, in so doing, I think it can help us imagine otherwise, you know? I mean, it certainly can make us imagine worse things sometimes, but it can also make us imagine better things, better possibilities. It can remind us that, you know, the world around us, like a sentence, is constructed. It can be rewritten, you know, and it can be remade. Having said that, you know, at the same time, I think I don't want to be one of those people who is like, don't read my, you know, my shit autobiographically. And I also don't want to be one of those people who's like, definitely read my shit autobiographically. I mean, fiction's really important to me. You know, I really want my mom to know, you know, there's a scene with a gun. At no point in the novel did I pull a gun on anyone or in my life, you know, that's really important to me. And I think additionally, you know, fiction can really make important and powerful things happen autobiographically. You know, I mean, that same friend of mine, after reading the book, texted me, you know, I'm sorry for the hateful shit that I said back in the day, you know, and then I said, you know, oh, I'm also sorry for these things. And this is a friend I've known, I guess, for about 15 years, you know, and this was a conversation we had never been able to have with each other, you know. So you want to honor in some ways that fiction has that kind of disappearing act, you know, that at times it makes you think that it's real, even when you know that it's not. And at times it makes you think that it's not real, when in fact the book that you're reading is a part of the real world. I think we have a lot to gain if we honor that it is both of these things, that at the moment that you think that you know what is real, in fact, it might be fiction.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, so full disclosure, is that I also grew up in Florida, not exactly in the same area as Elias, but it's something, you know, in knowing each other, we've talked about quite a lot. And, you know, one of something that's so, the like such an intense realism of the novel for me is just how present Florida is and how it exists in a way that I feel like I haven't seen it really represented, honestly, to my own experience and in other places. And yeah, it's set specifically in Flagler County, which is sort of like mid to north East Coast Florida. But it, I grew up in Southeast Coast Florida, very similar feeling. And yeah, you're so good at scene setting and placing someone there. And it's not just these descriptions of the landscape, but all of the signaling that happens. And I think even in that first chapter that you started to read from, you're able to like just sketch out these really significant elements of like the political and economic climate of the state, just with like little subtle touchstones. So, you know, in the portion that you read, there's the Confederate bumper sticker on Aubrey's sister's truck. And so like, that's obviously like a huge signal. But then also, once Aubrey and Daniel get into the boat, they're like floating down the intercoastal and they're getting their fishing, like spear fishing basically. And Daniel's looking at the, like the different homes as they float down the intercoastal. And, you know, he's describing in one paragraph, these like plantation like mansions basically. And then, you know, like a few sentences later, he's like, yeah, and right next to them, there's a sprawling, like, or that sprawling lawn, and then the clearing where the RVs and the trailers are hooked up to trucks along the water. And so there's just like, one of the things that's so stark for me about having grown up there and about the place in general is just like the proximity and the seriousness of the inequality in the state. And it's not like, that's not a major theme of the book, but it's so present again, just like in these details that feel really subtle. But I wonder if you like, did you set out to write a Florida novel? Was that part of the project? Or did that come out of just like writing from, you know, your experience and scenes that you knew and were familiar to you?
Yeah, no, maybe, you know, I offered all three possible answers to such a question just now. I mean, what I'll say is, you know, I didn't necessarily set out, let's say, to write a Florida novel, but in other ways, I couldn't help but write a Florida novel. You know, I mean, some of this is just autobiographical. I was, like many Floridians, you know, living in, you know, or like many Floridians who've left, like living somewhere where people were constantly like, oh, Florida is so crazy. All this wild shit happens, you know, down there. Or, you know, maybe more specifically, like Florida is so racist or Florida is so classist, you know, and they'll say this in cities where it's like, I mean, we both know that police violence happens in the city, you know? So it's like, I don't know what this like suggestion that Florida is somehow like, you know, racist and where we live is like not racist is wild, you know? At the same time, I mean, I think that abjection is doing something for people, you know, that they're trying to expel something that people have a hard time confronting, you know? People don't really want to acknowledge the degree to which they are Florida or are complicit in Florida or are proximate to Florida, but it's a part of the country, you know? I mean, there's kind of no getting around that, at least at the moment, you know? And indeed, I think there are many people there who you lose and who you sacrifice when you do that kind of expulsion, when you do that kind of caricaturing and then pretending that that's something else, you know? And in this book, I think a lot of the people that I may be concerned with honoring, especially, or who may be called to me to describe are, yeah, poor folks, poor Black folks in that section of Florida who eke out a dignified and valuable and meaningful life and who I don't think are worth you know, demonizing or whatever, throwing out just because one is not happy. And in as much as I also am not happy with the political state of that place, you know, and in a way, I mean, it also really deeply shaped me. I mean, it's funny because in a way I didn't really write about the kind of inequalities in Florida explicitly, but certainly to anyone from Florida, it's all very legible, you know, and anyone who grew up there has some of the knowledge of the history, even if it's taught to you encoded in not exactly correct ways in schools, you know. But I mean, there's kind of no getting around that, you know, the Matanzas River is so named for a Huguenot massacre, which would then lead to, you know, indigenous genocide, you know, or that, you know, every year in Tallahassee, or attempted genocide, of course, indigenous people are still alive, you know, and every year in Tallahassee, they celebrate Andrew Jackson, you know, storming into Florida after the war was over, you know, to begin killing the indigenous people in the area, you know, and all of this is to say that in a way, I don't know that I set out to write a Florida novel, but I certainly think that Florida wrote me and I couldn't really escape that.
Yeah. We, you know, Daniel, I think there's like, he's going through this transformation, right? Or this like reconciliation with his own relationship to the state. So the main character is from Florida, moves to New York, kind of like tries to distance himself from, you know, his home and from growing up there and those experiences. And there's so many reasons for that, right? Like there's a lot of trauma that he experienced there, just like interpersonally and within his family. And there's like that reason for distance. But even in, again, just like in this really slim opening chapter, he gets to this point in conversation with Aubrey where she's like, you know, oh, you got to get a scholarship and you got to get out. And there's this always this kind of like funny narrative of getting trapped there or like trying to escape in a way that, yeah, I don't know. There's so many points in the novel for me where I'm like, is this just what high school is like? Is this what Florida was? Like hard to disentangle. That also was, you know, my own experience, but just how much people talked about like getting out all of the time and then what it means to come back and have to confront that again. Like that being part of the narrative propulsion of the novel was just like so compelling for me personally because it related deeply to my own experiences. But you know, there's also this, like, he has such a tension with like a love and a hate and a repulsion and an attraction, to the state itself and like to the parts of himself that, it represents in his relationship to it. And yeah, I would love to hear more of what you were thinking there.
Yeah. Yeah. I have two thoughts, you know, one is, just about one thing that's very specific to Florida and another thing that's maybe specific to the novel. You know, I mean, Florida oddly has like one of, as you know, but Florida oddly has one of the highest percentages of students who attend college who attend in-state college, you know, and that's of course because of the Bright Futures Scholarship, which is, you know, if you have a certain GPA and a certain SAT score, Florida State will pay for 70 or 80% of your schooling at a private school. And if it's even higher, they'll pay all of your tuition, you know. So in many ways, this is a good thing. You know, you want people to have school that's paid for and you want people to have the option to go to school. And at the same time, I think this gives a kind of sense of trappedness, you know, because indeed for many people who want to escape a place, going to college elsewhere can be a means of escaping that place because, you know, you're 18, you just graduated from high school. Maybe you worked a job that would employ you from 16 to 17, but you don't really have the kind of money that it takes to just sort of like up and move a lot of the time, you know? So you go where people will pay for you, or, you know, maybe you did get into a school in another state, but in fact, it's really expensive because you're paying out of state tuition, or it's a private school and it's just expensive because a private college is expensive. And so all of this is to say, there just are large numbers of people who stay in Florida because it's deeply incentivized to stay in Florida for your college education. And that can be a really strange thing in a way, because it means that you're incentivized kind of to stay even through one of your only means of escaping, you know? On the other hand, I think in this novel in particular, I mean, one way that, you know, one could, and I should say, yeah, I am, one of the things that's nice about this book being out is that I no longer have the final say about what the book means, you know? It's decided by readers and community of readers and interpreters. And So this is just my opinion about how, you know, I might read the book, but thankfully I no longer have the pressure or responsibility to do this all by myself. But one way I think that you could narrate this book is that it's the story of a kind of history of integration in America, you know, that there is a Daniel who lives in a post, you know, post Brown v. Board of Ed, post civil, you know, Civil Rights Act of 64, Florida, who goes to high school and has no choice about who he goes to high school with, and goes to high school with a mix of people. You know, I mean, he doesn't live in an all Black area. He lives in Palm Coast, you know, and so he ends up at high school with a large mix of people, and Palm Coast and Flagler County itself is really strange. I mean, within 30 minutes, you can drive from a beach town through a suburb onto a dirt road that is a rural like farming area where you'll see just Confederate flags, and all of those cultures in one are really close together. And all of those different people go to your school, you know, and you don't really choose that. And sometimes you just befriend whomever you befriend, you know, you just talk to someone at lunch and you talk to someone in your class, and eventually y'all just like joke and laugh. And eventually you're like, I guess we're friends, you know. Now, Daniel has violence at home. He's experiencing racism in the world and also in some ways at home. And he wants to get out, you know, and he wants to escape. And so he moves to New York and one finds out that in fact, you know, racism is maybe just a part of being Black in America. Two, wants to sort of escape this history and wants to escape that kind of integration and wants to be like, I'm only dating Black people. I'm only hanging out with Black people. My life is great. And yet his history actually still outpaces him. You know, ultimately, what he wants to do is try to live in a world where his past never happened at the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
That's not an option, you know. In the middle of the book, after Aubrey passes away, he kind of wants to go back in time. That's also not an option, you know, and ultimately he has to kind of come to a very difficult realization or synthesis where he lives in a world where he accepts that history did happen, that he can't pretend that it didn't happen or live in it, and then proceed to figure out how to make his life from there.
Yeah, there's this, I mean, it's so interesting how much of the book is like playing with his own recollection and how much like you as a reader know about the events of his past as well, because he's not totally, there's all these different social groups and different people that he's in conversation with, and he is not entirely, you know, truthful with each of them, but also like then therefore you don't know the truth of the situation as the reader. So there's all these like kind of narratives that fold in on themselves in terms of what were the events that actually happened. And I think that's so interesting too in terms of his, like Daniel's queerness as a character, because I think there's so much that happens when, you know, he doesn't realize when he's in high school that he is queer. That's a major kind of plot point of the book as well, of his like then coming out to his high school friends when he's back down there much later. And there's this sort of like process of revision that always happens as well, when you have to like look back on your life and say, well, what was going on there? And like, you know, what was the truth of these situations when I didn't know the truth of myself at a moment? And so I think it just like, it does such a nice way of modeling that for the reader as well, and trying to work through that. Because we don't really know until the very end of the book, like what his relationship with Aubrey actually looked like. You know, we know that it looked like love in some form, but like what the actual, you know, textures of it were, they're just kind of like breadcrumbed throughout the book.
Yeah. Sorry, were you about to say something?
No.
No, I mean, it's really funny. You know, I didn't really think about this, but, you know, in a way, it's like I was writing fiction to do something in my own life, you know, to grieve, to process my emotions. And in many ways, Daniel tells fiction, you know, Daniel lies, you know, he tells stories. He is in many ways a person who uses fiction in his day-to-day life for something, you know, and yeah, that kind of storytelling can be really, really important to people, but maybe especially to young people and especially to people who unfortunately have to confront, you know, the difficulty of death and then have to make some meaning about that, right? And have to get a sense of, well, that story actually, that past cannot be changed. All I can do is sort of think about what meaning it means to me, you know? And that I think is in many ways kind of at the heart of the book. And this is a thing that is also, it's not an individual practice. You know, he's telling one set of stories Other people are telling different stories. Certainly a very big and important part of the book, at least to me, is all of the sort of history about his family, the history of his family in Jamaica. And sometimes, you know, he'll be like, well, you know, I heard this one thing from my mom and I heard a different story from my aunt and an even different story from my grandmother. All of this is to say that, you know, in a way, many of us use fiction to sort of, yeah, patch over and make sense of the absences that are available to us sometimes. You know, I mean, I think there are some ways in which Daniel lies that I'm not trying to defend here. I mean, he does some kind of just like bad lying, which if you read the book, you will see. And I think some of what Daniel's trying to confront is also that he doesn't know certain things. And in fact, when someone passes, that you can't know certain things, you know, that after they have passed away, you can't actually call them up and ask, what were you thinking? What did you do? And then of course, even if you could, if I ask you, you know, what you were thinking 10 years ago when this thing happened,
yeah,
you might give me an answer. Neither of us actually knows if that's true, you know, or accurate. And that I think is like, yeah, I don't know, that kind of storytelling is like so central to small town life also, because you have all these people who are telling different stories. Nobody really knows, or if they know once, they often don't remember. And those things can really affect the life that you live, you know, I mean, and people will treat you differently based upon those stories. And you want to do your best to kind of try to make a story that works for you as an individual, but also takes on the sort of obligations and responsibilities of living in a community with other people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's so much of the book that is really just, is also like, not just Daniel's story, but his mother's story and his mother's history. And that comes in so many nice ways. But then there's also so much that is just like them kind of him talking with Desmond and other friends, and they're all just like fronting with each other. So they're not telling exactly the truth to each other too. They're always exaggerating and teasing and these other things. So you're getting like only these sort of like, as you said earlier, like slant versions of a story in a certain way, because it's like, A, what do they remember? And B, not just what do they remember, but like, what do they want their friends to think? Which is always, it's so much like in the culture of their friendship and the way that they're all talking to each other. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like a big thing. I mean, I think especially for boys, especially for high school boys, that kind of like front and bullshit and storytelling, lying, you know, I mean, really like sometimes it's like, you know, because I also used to teach high school, and it would be really funny because sometimes students would say things that you can see that other students would believe, but that if you're an adult, you know for a fact that there is absolutely no way that sentence is true. You know, I mean, I distinctly remember I taught at a high school, at a private high school outside of Philly, and there weren't that many Black students. And I remember one Black student telling this story about like going to a really crazy house party, you know, in West Philly, where he got shot in the chest. And I was like, there's literally no way you got shot in the chest on Saturday and came to school on Monday. You know, so it's like, this is actually just like not true, you know, but like all of these kids around you're like, that kid's really tough. You know, it's like, this just didn't happen, you know, but there's that need, you know, for acceptance, you know, for people who are insecure, often the way that they get that acceptance can be lying, you know, and even by the end of the book, you know, I don't know that Daniel's necessarily figured those things out. It's important to me that Daniel's not perfect, you know, yeah. Nor is the person that he idolizes or tells lies about perfect, you know. Indeed, I think ultimately they're just trying to find a process to get better.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny, like having that story from the high school boys in contrast to what actually goes on in the novel, which is everyone's trying to like not talk about getting in a particular fight at a certain point. But there's the tension between like wanting the bravado, but then not wanting to get in trouble for it at the same time. But yeah, another thing that I wanted to talk about in relation to high school was just driving around. Because, you know, for me, and I think for many people who grew up in Florida, and again, this is totally like a, was it high school or was it Florida? Like, does this happen in every suburban area? But I think particularly like the driving age in Florida is just so young that people have cars or have access to cars or try to get access to cars all the time. And then the thing you do is like the one person who has a car, you just sit in the car and drive around. And so much of the novel is just like actually in the space of the car, is people driving around and having conversations, is Daniel like looking out of a window and then reminiscing, and then you kind of like go down a rabbit hole of you know, flashback or storytelling telling, like recounting something. And yeah, were you like intentionally using driving around as a structuring device? Did it just start happening? Was it just Desmond couldn't shut up and, you know, he was driving the car?
kind of. I mean, yeah, I think it was kind of definitely more, I think, the latter of those two things to some degree. I mean, I think, yeah, in a way, there was just a sort of like basic plot issue, you know, at one point where I was like, well, I know that they're here and I know they need to get there.
You know? That's how we all ended up in the car.
And along the way, I think it led to some really good conversations. But I think also like in a way that this is also kind of just true to my experience of Florida, you know, I mean, if you live somewhere, if you grew up somewhere where there isn't public transit, like that moment when your first friend gets their driver's license and has a car to borrow from their parents or has their own car or whatever, you know, that is huge. You know, it's like the first time that you have any control over where you go, which in a way for you kind of becomes control over what you do, who you want to be, what sorts of things you want to say, you know? I mean, sure, in theory, you could walk or bicycle in my hometown, but, you know, aside from a close friend of mine who lived a half mile away, I had another friend in my neighborhood who was about a 2 mile walk, you know, that's just not close, you know, and so I'm not going to walk for an hour to go see this person, you know, or at least not all the time. And that kind of independence, I think, is really key. And I think it's also a big part of Florida. I mean, I think another thing in the book, of course, is like, yeah, it does revolve around a drunk driving accident, you know, and that kind of problem. I mean, the reason that there are so many drunk driving accidents in that part of Florida or in Florida more generally is just deep infrastructural disinvestment. You know, I mean, a government that knows that there are means of preventing drunk driving deaths, namely by providing people alternatives, because you know that in fact people will drink and drive. So you have to give people other ways of getting from one place to another. That kind of infrastructural disinvestment, how could one escape writing that if you're writing about Florida? It does determine everything that you're able to do, down to the fact that ultimately, you know, you need to go to the grocery store and that is just a 15-minute drive away if there's no traffic at the one stoplight in your town, you know?
Yeah. I think that kind of there's an interesting thing going back to what you're saying about everyone being in the same high school too, because I think there's a way in which there is these kind of like cross class alliances that had to be made too, because you're like, oh, that person has the car and we got to get somewhere. And so these unlikely friendships that start to be made by like necessity and trying to figure out, how to get to where you want to go, how to get to the beach, because there isn't public transit that'll take you there. And it's going to just like take way too long to walk, even though it's not all that far.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, I hadn't thought about it, but it's like, yeah, ideally, if you were, you know, a Florida teen, you have some cross-class friends, or at least you have some friends who have the means of having a car, you know, because ultimately, like, if no one has a car, then it's like, you really just can't do much, you know? I mean, even if people were closer, it's like, well, in August, every day in the afternoon, it's just going to thunderstorm, you know? So you, like, that kind of limits whether or not you can walk somewhere. It's also, you know, basically, like, March to November, it's going to be above 80 degrees. That also limits how far you're going to, you know, travel on foot outside. You actually need that air conditioned car, you know, or maybe not need, you know, my mom's car's air conditioning broke at one point. I do remember that we lived with it fine, but it certainly wasn't my favorite thing not to have it, you know?
Yeah. There's just really like so much more to potentially talk about, but maybe we switch to questions for a little bit and
that sounds great.
See what people are saying. So Will Straw from Canada says that he thought this was the best novel he read all year. Don't disagree. but he's asking, what did you think of the description of the book as millennial noir? He's referencing this recent Times review that came out. And he says he thinks it both works, but is also misleading.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's true that Daniel himself, I mean, as Rachel pointed out, Daniel is not often telling the truth to himself. You know, certainly in the beginning of the book, he's lying to himself. And Daniel thinks that he has some questions and is trying to unravel a story. And his friends are like, no, 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 this is about something else. You know, I think you're just mad that this person is dead, you know? And he's like, no, I just want to know what happened. How did it happen? Where was she? Who was she? Whatever. So to some degree, there's that detective element there. I thought it was a cool, you know, description. I mean, I must say I didn't, at no point was I like, let me write this as millennial noir. You know, that's not a genre that I, you know, had thought of as existing, nor is it that I knew what it meant. But I think in some ways, as a description, I, even if it doesn't capture everything, I do like some of the things that it opens up. I mean, I think some of the ways of thinking about the kind of powerlessness with which Daniel is faced, the kind of like chagrin towards the world, as well as there are a lot of ways I think in which American masculinity presents itself as different from, let's say, 1940s Humphrey Bogart, the great noir star, of course. And there are a lot of ways I think in which queer men, myself included, sometimes think that we are very different from earlier kinds of masculinity that we see on screen as noir. And I think for, you know, at least for Daniel, that's not entirely true. I mean, I think Daniel definitely valorizes certain of those things of masculinity and also is just in some way straight up sexist. And some of the women in the novel, like, have to call him out on that, you know? And yeah, so I think that that to me is how I feel about it. You know, I think it maybe is most interesting for what it says about the gender dynamics of the book.
Yeah. One of the things I loved about the review was how it just kind of like notes how often Daniel keeps getting rescued by women in like kind of unlikely ways. So he's sort of like, if he's the star detective of the book, he's really a bad detective. Like
terrible. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like he's you know, asking all of the wrong questions and, you know, figuring things, like doesn't even know what he doesn't know at a certain point.
Or what he's looking for, you know? Yeah, I mean, truly would be the, like, the worst.
He knows what he's looking for. And everyone's like, no. but it's fun. I think thinking of it as the caper is, like, really funny in a certain way because it just ends up being not that at all. And also, I think he's, like, having this detective mission, right? It's like, you need something to do at a certain point. Like he had to have a reason to actually, he wasn't just like going home to deal with his feelings, right? Like, and so that kind of like resonates back with what you were saying about his like masculinity, is he couldn't just like say like, oh, I am having a difficult time like confronting intimacy and like this intimacy that I had with this person and how that is impacting the other intimacies in my life. He was like, I need to find out why she died, like exactly how and why, and like goes on that mission, but it's not the mission that he needs to be on or is actually on.
and I don't want to pathologize it per se, you know, I mean, I think, you know, obviously there are things that Daniel does that I don't endorse, and also it's really normal when someone passes to ask, what don't I know about their life? How can I learn some of those things? You know, and I think, you know, to me, I think when I have felt whole after grieving, in which I feel more or less like I am in parts, is when I am grateful for what I know of the person and for having known that person. And I'm okay with the things that I don't know, you know, and that's a big part of that journey as well. Like Daniel is sort of also plumbing his way through his family history. And everywhere, you know, is finding absences.
Yeah.
He has to sort of come to terms with the fact that there are some things that he can't know, and he can still sort of live and proceed and make sense of himself, both as a person and as a person who exists in relationship to a history of slavery and indenture, as well as love and happiness.
Yeah. Dan Westwood says that he heard you refer to fiction as a technology, and asked if you could elaborate on what you meant by that.
Yeah, that's a good question. Oh, I don't know if I thanked Will. Also, thank you, Will, for that question. And also thank you, Dan, for this question. Yeah, that's a description that I use all the time. This is kind of one of those like hilarious things, I think, in particular about this time where you like don't talk to that many people. And then you're, you know, you say this thing and someone else is like, what does that mean? I think to me, you know, I think about a novel as a technology in that I think a novel does something, you know, I think it is a, on the one hand, it's certainly like a historical development. As a genre, we know it just didn't exist before a certain point in history. People might argue about when that point is, but everyone basically agrees there's like no novel in 1200 AD in English, you know, in any European language. So it develops in a way, and it develops out of a lot of things. And in that way, it's like a technology, but maybe more importantly to me, fiction is a really strange technology. You know, for Daniel, let's say lying, you know, storytelling, that can make him feel better, that can make him look cool, it can do whatever, you know. And, you know, I think for us as readers, as writers, you know, novels do things, you know, I mean, one of the funny things about a novel is that it's in some ways like it's a strange technology in that, like, well, you know, you can only do so many things with a hammer. I can write a book and you can read this book in a like totally different way. You know, I mean, you might be like kind of creative with a hammer, but ultimately you're just not going to use it that differently from me. But you can use a novel in a totally different way to do a lot of different things for oneself. I think that's what I mean by a novel, you know, it's a imaginative memory creating technology, but the memories and the imaginations that it creates are wildly different depending on who's using it and how.
Yeah. I think it was interesting also hearing you at the beginning talk about like how you were using it as the author of it too, and how that's, you know, has resonances with, but is also different in so many ways from, you know, the way a reader's going to use the novel, or as we've talked about also, like what a critic might do with a novel, which is, you know, make other kinds of meaning of it or use it for arguments for other things. Kind of jumping back to that earlier conversation we were having, Dan Sisla, sorry, I hope I'm saying that right. Dan asks, how early in writing this did you know it was a novel?
Thanks for that question, Dan. I don't know. Yeah, probably when I couldn't stop doing it, you know. yeah, I wish I had a really good answer for you, but ultimately I just sort of I kept writing, you know. I, you know, would get somewhere and be like, well, actually, you know, and I mean, ultimately the way that this worked for me is that I tried really hard at any given time to know, at least for myself, what the characters wanted, you know. And I tried to be honest about what I think the characters thought, you know. This all seems like a really strange way to describe something, because obviously none of these things are real. So what does it mean to be honest about what an imaginary Daniel was thinking? But that is how I thought about it. And I just sort of followed their desires, you know, to the next point. I didn't actually know where this book was going to end. I maybe in my mind was like, there are some places in Flagler County that I would like to describe in the book, aside from a chapter in New York and the past tense scenes, doesn't really leave Flagler County.
Yeah.
And effectively, you know, after a certain point, those desires just kind of drove me to something that was long, you know. It's like I had to keep writing to see what people were going to do next until I was like, okay, I think now everyone has sort of met their desires, has sort of like had those desires fulfilled in a way that doesn't create some other new desire that necessitates writing about. And B, you know, the book ends at like 4 a.m., you know, it's like, they're probably just going to go to bed now. You know, it's pretty late and I can't actually realistically keep them up any longer.
Did you, I mean, I think it sort of, with the exception of the New York scene, it really takes place over like the course of 2 days, but really, for the most part, like a single day. And I guess they just have to, you're right, like go to bed. You end up at the ocean and you have to go to bed.
Yeah. I mean, in a funny way, you know, I realized that the book was over when I was like, well, Daniel would have to go home and then go to work, you know, and work is the end of all good stories, maybe. No, I don't think that
works. This is not a workplace novel. Thank you, Dan. Another kind of related question is Gerald John Thompson asks, can you talk about your journey and novel development process from first draft to being done? I feel like you've done a lot of that kind of gesturally talking about the characters, but is there anything more you want to speak to there?
Yeah, thanks, Gerald. That's a good question. I think, you know, the first draft, you just hear some voices, you know, and you're like, I just got to write this down. And I got to write this down like now, you know, because like, I don't know if I'm going to lose it. And that's how things sort of start. And then eventually, you know, as happens, like life gets in the way, you know. I don't know what it was that pulled me away from this book, but I remember having, you know, to take some step away from writing it at some point. And then I had to come back and I was like, oh no, like, am I going to be able to keep writing this? And then I kept writing. And at first, on that first day, it felt really, really bad, you know, and this is all still in the first draft. It's just like third or fourth chapter, maybe. And felt really, really bad, you know, and then I read it the next day and I was like, oh, this actually doesn't read that bad. I think I'm just inconfident because I've had some time away, you know. And So eventually, you know, you develop the will to just keep going, you know, and to keep going until it's done. Then you have a really weird problem on your hands where you're like, well, I just wrote like 70,000 words. I have like, I've never done this before. I don't know how to make this into like a cohesive thing. And so for me, I thought about this and I was like, well, okay, I've written this book. I feel a lot better now personally. What do I want from this? And then I thought to myself, I was like, I want to tell this story well. I want to write sentences that I think are pretty sometimes, not in all of the book, but sometimes. And I want my friends to think that this is cool, you know? And so then, you know, as I was drafting, I was like, okay, let me send this to some friends whose opinions I really, really respect, you know, who I think just have really, really good taste. And I eventually was like, okay, this actually isn't ready to send this to them, but I want to write a book that would impress these friends. You know, I want my friends to think that I'm cool because of course I was still very insecure and am admittedly still kind of insecure. But I wanted my friends to think that the book was cool, you know, four friends in particular, you know, and I knew that if it was good to them, if they thought that it had promise, then I had something, you know? And so then I wrote another draft and then eventually I was like, okay, I'm going to send this to them, get their feedback, and then I will do maybe two more drafts. And then I was like, I'm broke. I really need to publish this. And then I made my way towards that. And I was really lucky to encounter really great readers early along the way in N+1, getting an excerpt published. My agents, Jin and Alex, you know, amazing, wonderful readers. My editor, Elaine, also an editor at Norton, Mo Christ, and they really helped to shape the book. Because ultimately, after a certain point, I guess what I'm trying to say is, alone, you can only take a story so far. You actually need feedback and you need support, and you can know that the stories that you tell are collective endeavors. That can take some pressure off, but it can also make it more meaningful.
There are so many more questions and we only have 5 minutes left. So
I'll talk less and answer to them.
No. I don't think that, I don't think we'll possibly be able to get to all of them, but, a nice kind of sign off question potentially is that Candace McKinley asks that she knows you've just birthed this novel, which is quite a feat, but have you thought about other themes or questions that you want to explore next?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, kind of like everybody, you know, coming out of this really strange time, really interested in parties. You know, as a person, I don't want to go to a party by any means. You know, I find parties like stressful and whatever, maybe get a little anxious. And also I'm like sober now. So I also am like, well, now I can't use alcohol to deal with that anxiety. So like, what am I going to do? Just like sit around and smoke, you know? So yeah. But I am really interested in those kinds of human gatherings. You know, what happens when people talk to each other? How do people relate to each other? I mean, I think, yeah, I've been thinking a lot about how much of the book is so firmly rooted in one character's perspective, and then we get pulled out of that character's perspective at times because other people start talking and they sort of work their way in because the character is narrating what their mother tells them, what have you. And then at one moment, a different character narrates. But I'm a little bit more interested in those kinds of things where it's like, what if we think about how everybody's thinking about something in their head, you know, which is kind of the really strange thing of a party. Like, you know, everybody gets in a room for whatever reason. We've all decided that like Bad and Bougie, one, amazing, two, a song that you dance to like this, you know, with your like hands up and not like your like arms crossed as though, you know, we're 10 years prior. And that kind of like coded understanding that we all know and that we all co-create, but we come to it with different meanings and reasons. That's something I'm really interested in, I think. You know, I mean, I think additionally, one thing that I think a lot about, you know, I happen to really like some of those novels of manners. And I mean, both sort of like canonical white ones like Eliot's Middlemarch or like Edith Wharton. I find that stuff interesting, but also things like, you know, Zadie Smith's novels of manners. I think Alice Childress's Long Walk has a kind of interesting spin on that genre. Kristen Latney's first book also has an interesting spin on that genre in the 60s. The last three authors I just named were all Black authors. And I think I have not yet seen anybody think deeply or take seriously about how poor Black folks, where I'm from, where I grew up and the place that kind of made me and that I kind of want to honor that, you know, that it made me. I haven't really seen anyone take seriously how those folks are communicating with each other in really subtle gestures, you know, how a look might signal, for instance, disdain or love, you know, or how whatever, wearing a particular outfit can signal one thing and wearing a different outfit will signal something entirely differently, but only to the people who know, you know, that kind of like in-group co-created meaning. That's stuff that I think I'm really interested in, partially because we've all been oddly starved of that. You know, I mean, in the pandemic, I haven't actually had that many opportunities to be whatever in large gatherings with people, you know, where I'm witnessing those things happen. We've all had to sort of like say what we think in like emails or in text or on Zoom meetings, you know, and I've missed those cues. I miss those cues a lot, you know, and I think that they're really interesting. So I think that that's a really long-winded way of saying, I'm not really sure, but I do want to think deeply about how it is that a certain group of people communicate who I think are not particularly well represented in that genre.
Seems very pointed and clear to me, but we'll just have to wait for Elias's next novel. Yeah, it's about 8:30 now, so we're probably going to wrap it up. There is a link in the chat if anyone wants to order this really exceptional book. Please do so. Please take the time to read it. Thank you so much, Elias, for writing the book, for talking to me about it, for being you.
Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure. And yeah, thank you everyone for coming.
Yeah, thanks everyone for coming. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.